Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. Join us at commentarymagazine.com. Follow us on Twitter at Commentary. Like us on Facebook at Commentary. I'm at J. Podhoretz at Commentary. With me, as always, is at Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And at Noah C. Rothman, our assistant online editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
Of course, it is the morning after the all-important, epic-altering vice presidential debate between Tim Kaine and Mike Pence. The common consensus is that, as a matter of performance, Pence wiped the floor with Kaine, but possibly as a matter of content, Pence dropped some huge time bombs in his own path by making rather bald-faced claims that Donald Trump didn't say all sorts of things that we've all heard Donald Trump say time and again. So, of course, the story, the question is whether this is going to make any difference in the course of what appears to be the second meltdown in 2 months of the Trump campaign following the bad debate a week ago, and the polling, which universally seems to suggest a very significant move toward Hillary Clinton, not only nationally, but in the states that she needs to win to deny Donald Trump any kind of a path to the White House. In particular, it appears that she is now pulled substantially away from any possibility of him winning the state of Pennsylvania, and is taking a lead in North Carolina. If she wins North Carolina and also has a lead in Florida, there is literally no way that Trump can get to 270 electoral votes. So the only meaning that the vice presidential debate might have is whether the dynamic of the last week was that depressed Republicans started moving away from Trump into the undecided column or into the Gary Johnson column, and whereas Hillary was seeing Democrats suddenly feeling like, okay, we can vote for her. And maybe Pence, with his superior performance, altered that a little bit. Noah, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I think you summed it up pretty well. To the extent that Mike Pence demonstrated some competence at the top of the ticket, which conservatives have been really wanting to see and haven't had any opportunity to see it, I think it's going to make everybody kind of happy. Like you said, there were a lot of misstatements by Mike Pence, a bizarre gaffe about that Mexican thing, which has become a trending topic. Reporters and journalists aren't talking about it, but everywhere else outside of that sphere, people are.
Yeah, you dug up that Mexican thing,
yeah,
you said.
That's a gaffe, so I'm not sure how long it'll last. But I think conservatives are going to overblow this because they want competence, and they haven't had any, and they finally have some. So there'll be some Republican movement, maybe. But this is the last you're going to see of Mike Pence. I mean, he's gone. The next 35 days are dominated by Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And the thing is that we had these awesome reports after this debate from people like New York Times, John Harwood, and others, who suggested that the Trump campaign, people around Donald Trump, were suggesting that he was unhappy with Mike Pence's performance because he was competent, good, upstaged him, and kind of refused to defend him. There's an easy way to test that proposition, right? If we see Mike Pence out on the trail, if we see them putting Mike Pence front and center because he did so well, that will have no merit. It'll make no sense, and they'll get the shot in the arm that they need ahead of Sunday. If we don't see him, which I suspect we won't, there's probably some merit to those reports.
You know, it was also completely surreal, not only that he sort of denied accusation after accusation about Donald Trump, but the way in which Pence completely went against the Trump campaign's treatment of Vladimir Putin up till that point too. It's as if Pence was saying, "This is how, if you want to be a sort of normal conservative and get on the Trump train, this is how you go about it. You just pretend that everything that Trump has said and done hasn't really done. Pretend his positions are keep your own positions, but just stay along with him and just and ignore anything that Trump contributes to it.
Pence attacked Hillary Clinton on the reset from the right, the Russian reset. Trump attacks Hillary on the Russian reset from the left, claiming that the reset was ineffective because she didn't succeed in winning Putin over and instead alienated him and showed up her and Barack Obama's weak leadership. Pence made this passionate case for Putin as a small-minded bully who invaded Crimea and invaded the Ukraine and invaded Georgia and is just the worst person in the world. And, you know, if he had been Mitt Romney's running mate in 2012, that would have been perfectly fine. It was startling out of his mouth. And even more disturbing, I have to say, his utter poo-pooing as Tim Kaine, who was incredibly ineffectual, kept saying, but that's not what Donald Trump says. And then Pence is like, yes, it is. And then he said, well, you and Donald Trump both said that Putin was a stronger leader than Barack Obama. And Pence said, that's absolutely not true. So then you literally Google Pence, Putin, and Obama. And Pence 4 weeks ago said, it's inarguable that Vladimir Putin is a stronger leader in his country than Barack Obama is in his country. He said it. He denied it. You don't usually get lying like that. You know, the more you think about it, the more discomforting it is. Like, he's coming across as a kind, thoughtful, serious, you know, low-key guy, and then he just bald-faced lies. But usually politicians bend themselves into pretzels not to lie, like to do everything but lie, to mislead, to recharacterize, to falsely characterize, but not to lie about something he had just said.
Well, it was almost like he turned off flicked a master switch. Like we're going to ignore Donald Trump, the real person.
Now, and this,
all
by the way,
the board.
Right. Now, the other way you can look at this is that this is the new reality that Donald Trump has introduced into American politics, which is you just say anything. You just say anything, and the onus, therefore, is on your interlocutor, who then says, you know, it's like the guy in the pigeon sketch in Monty Python. You know, you say, this pigeon is dead. And he says, no, it's not. And then he bangs the pigeon on the table. He's like, he's just sleeping. Like, you know, and meanwhile, John Cleese in the Monty Python sketch starts going completely stark, raving, insane because this thing is being denied right before his eyes. Now, Kaine was obnoxious, and he, not only was he ineffectual, the interesting thing about him is the person that was there interrupting 70 times in the course of 90 minutes is not Tim Kaine. That's not, everybody says he's a nice guy, he's a pleasant guy, he's a civil guy, you know, he's a Boy Scout. That he was trained to do this. There was a conscious decision for him to be this, like, utterly aggressive guy, and it was really stupid, and it calls into question because you don't have someone mimic a personality they don't have, and it calls into question the political skills and what in Yiddish would be called the seichel of the Clinton campaign, that this is the person they thought they needed to go up against Mike Pence.
Well, that was one of the weird things about his performances, that he was playing to an audience that I think was sort of doing the Monday morning quarterback thing. Like, he wasn't really fact-checking, as you say, in the middle of the debate. He was just sort of offering a litany and then letting a lot of weird balls drop. Like, there was this one moment where Mike Pence was asked about homegrown terrorism and what your plans are to deal with American citizens who are radicalized over the internet and then execute attacks that the FBI just can't anticipate or can't catch chatter and know about ahead of time. What is your plan to deal with that? And Mike Pence went off on Syrian refugees, demonstrating that he has no plan, no idea how to deal with that. And rather than call him out on that, Tim Kaine went off on Syrian refugees and how noble it is to have Syrian refugees and how the courts have said that you can't impose on or you can't reject, states can't reject what the federal government wants to do with refugees. It was a really weird opportunity missed, and there were a couple of those. And like you said, I think he was just waiting for the third arm of the other column of the Hillary Clinton campaign, which is the political press, to come clean up a lot of that mess.
I mean, the other thing that was so bizarre is he had memorized so much, and there was too much. And it was as though, you know, you get these memos. I mean, I remember in my brief sojourn as a political speechwriter, it's like, well, what should we write about? And then it's like, mention this, mention that, mention the other thing, do this. This department says you need to mention, pro-choice. This one says you've got to talk about immigration. This one says you've got to do this. So Kane, in response, did everything in 90 minutes. It was like he was, in his head, he was checking off every talking point that he was supposed to make to appeal to every group and then get the zingers in, too, that he had memorized. And there was this point where he said something like, you just did blah, blah, blah. Here are four things. Right. You know, one, two, three, four. And then at some other point he said, six times I've said to you, you must be ashamed to run with Donald Trump. And six times you haven't answered the question. Because, again, the people in Brooklyn who were training him said, you know, here's a good way to approach it. Say, I can't believe you as a good person would be on a ticket with Donald Trump, which is the dumbest debating move. It's like debating 101. You don't leave an open question hanging in the air if you're a debater, because the other person can just ignore it or say, sure, I'm running with Donald Trump. What are you talking about? And then it's like, well, you shouldn't. Yes, I should. Well, you shouldn't. Yes, I should. And then it's like, you're badgering me. Leave me alone.
Here's why I don't know.
He was terrible. Like, the notion that that guy that we saw, let's say Hillary Clinton wins and she can only serve a term or she serves two terms. Yeah, that guy is going to ever be president unless, you know, something catastrophic happens, is beyond belief. It was one of the worst. I said in a column today in the New York Post, it was the worst debating performance since Dan Quayle in 1988, and was arguably worse than Quayle, which is a pretty low bar. You know,
well, his manner was worse. It was less appealing. Kane. Yeah. I mean, he was because he was interrupting and sort of clucking at.
Yeah, but I think even when he's trying to be appealing, as in his convention speech, he's not especially appealing. There's something sort of like icky about him, or not interesting about him. You know, he's like nothing. You know, but here's behind the scenes, apparently he's just lovely. So I'll believe
he seems
that.
Lovely. The thinking, I think, is that these things don't matter. VP debates don't matter. People don't vote for the vice president. So the only objective here is to get in Donald Trump's head and force another meltdown. I think they succeeded. Why not? All they had was Mike Pence, A, showing up his running mate at the top of the ticket, B, disowning him virtually on stage, and that's going to be the takeaway. The press is going to be very well sure that they fact-checked the heck out of all of his distancing from Mike Pence. And we know Donald Trump gets a little flustered when the people around him start acting a little untrustworthy. You had Eric Trump yesterday on cable making a fool of himself. And one of the things he said in a very bizarre Godfather kind of way was that Mike Pence did the family proud. He didn't go against the family, which is creepy enough. But the fact that they're saying that and that they're thinking that...
Well, he was a good representative of the family.
The family.
As
right.
though the family were running for president, as though
Luca Brasi has a message.
No, it's, you know, it's Tom Hagen.
Right.
He was Tom Hagen. He's a consigliere. He may not be a wartime consigliere.
Well, you're out, Tom.
He may not be a wartime consigliere. Well, so, and Trump will be his own consigliere. So, that stuff last night on Twitter about John Harwood and John King and a couple of other people saying... I think that came from one source, that someone close to Trump said this is not going to be good because Trump won't be happy about someone upstaging him. Who would have said so? Who would say such a thing? If you want Trump to, why are you causing a controversy on the night of the vice presidential debate if you're close to Trump and you want Trump to be president? Why are you introducing this note by talking to senior reporters at CNN, the New York Times about this? there's something fishy going on there. I don't quite know what it is. You know, I don't know who it was, and I don't know what it is. I don't know what it means to be close to Trump. No one is close to Trump, or everyone's close to Trump. It seemed like an act of kind of peculiar mischief to me.
That or attempt to ingratiate himself with Trump.
Right, you mean by saying...
By saying, I've got
I'm the only loyal one.
Right.
Right.
And I'm close.
Well, the fact, by the way, that it was John King of CNN would suggest that it was Corey Lewandowski, right? I mean, that would be the obvious...
it fits his MO.
Ex-campaign manager... Now, you know, now CNN, you know, now CNN's paid Trump guy who's also being paid by Trump to be on CNN. So in the great corrupt media circus that we're now in.
But the future, I mean, in the very near future, again, I don't expect to see Mike Pence on the trail because I think there's probably a real grain of truth to that. The guy has never in his life played second fiddle to anybody. Why on earth would he want to subordinate himself to Mike Pence, even though Mike Pence is clearly the better messenger?
Well, you don't have to subordinate yourself. It's fine. You know, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. The guy won. This is where it's weird. This is where it's like, not to use a term Trump would use, but it's like loser's logic. You have a guy running for vice president. You have a vice presidential debate. 20 million people are going to watch, or 30 million people are going to watch, and your guy wins. So he wins. So it's better for your ticket that he wins than if he loses. So if Trump turns on him because he wins rather than loses, that's a loser. And comports himself well, and Trump needs to consolidate the Republican base. And Pence's message was entirely a Republican message, a pro-life message, a hawkish message, a nationalist message, and... And so Trump is going to quash him like a bug? That's what a loser does, not what a winner does.
But I think that fits Trump's MO. I mean, this is what we were saying last time. He has to retaliate, or he has to lash out regardless of how it redounds to his own fortune.
I mean, right. Well, the other thing about last night, which I thought was striking, is that we are seeing Syria came up and ISIS came up. But what did not come up is the fact that earlier this week, Secretary of State John Kerry announced that our wonderful peace arrangement with the Russians and the Syrians was now at an end, as though it weren't at an end the minute that he had announced it with such fanfare 3 weeks ago, as the Russians in Syria are, you know, committing war crimes in Aleppo and attempting basically to destroy a city in which hundreds of thousands of people find themselves trapped, going on right before our eyes. Who's talking about this? This is the central fact of the world right now. Two central facts in the world. There's a hurricane bearing down on the southeastern part of the United States that could be a Category 5, and we could see damage of the sort we haven't seen since Sandy and maybe since Hurricane Andrew. And there is a city on the planet that is being bombed out of existence with 100,000, with 250,000 people still in it. And in neither of the debates, and we'll see what happens on Sunday night in the second presidential debate, in neither of the debates had these candidates been asked to address either contingency.
Well, this is amazingly, this is one opportunity that Mike Pence did use to criticize Vladimir Putin last night. He said something like, "If this keeps up, if Putin continues to assist in the bombarding of civilians in Aleppo, then I would, as if a Trump administration would take military action."
Yeah, but that's of course preposterous. Yeah. Right. That's like science fiction. So he mentions it, and then he said the one thing that we know of a total certainty that Donald Trump will never do is right. bomb Vladimir Putin's army.
Right.
I'm about to write on this, actually. So, dear listener, please read my piece on this. It's probably out by now. This is the worst moment of this debate because it was absolutely rooted in no reality. Both Mike Pence and Tim Kaine adopted the idea that we should have safe zones on the ground in Syria. That goes further than Hillary Clinton ever went. Hillary Clinton advocated for a no-fly zone. She backed off that when the Russians interceded in the conflict and then created a lot of their own airspace that they're operating in on their own. Now we have S-300 anti-air defense systems in Syria. Russia has used them as a deterrent very explicitly. Said if the United States executes attacks on Assad's regime, which apparently we're, if you believe Josh Rogan's reporting in the Washington Post, which I do, the State Department is advocating, and they're getting roadblocked by the White House, that they, the Russians, will intervene, that they will regard that as an attack on them, and then we have a shooting war between the United States and Russia. That's not happening. And nobody decided, and this was the moderator's job, decided to say, look, this is not reality that you're talking about. You're making up a whole idea of Syria that doesn't exist. This is the Syria of 2013 when the Russians weren't on the ground and in the air. You have to create a no-fly zone and then put a lot of men on the ground in order to secure sovereign territory inside Syria and keep them there in perpetuity from the, in the north and the south and border of Lebanon and border of Turkey. There's no way that's going to happen. Nobody's talking about that seriously. So to float something like that in a debate is incredibly insulting to the American people's intelligence and to the to the public who's watching. And frankly, the moderator last night should have said something about that, but I don't think they had any of the background knowledge on this situation. It's been moving pretty fast. But that was really a moment when we were all very sincerely failed by both these candidates peddling fictions about Syria.
Right. So as we go through this week, the political questions that are facing everybody are these. Will Trump stanch the bleeding until Sunday night and then do something to either continue to stanch bleeding or to reverse his momentum, if you believe in political momentum, which I don't really. Will Hillary Clinton manage not to step on her own story, though her husband seems to be making a very strong effort to step on her story by going on a very interesting and totally bizarre attack on Obamacare yesterday, which was very fluent and quite right about how people are paying twice as much and having their premiums cut in half. It's the craziest thing in the world that it's like this, thus calling into question yet again whether or not there's something going on in his brain that is not normal, because this was not only not...
This is the kind of honesty that he's not known for.
He's not known for, and is, you know, is the sort of thing where, you know, all Hillary Clinton needs is for Barack Obama to get mad at her and not go all out for the next month when she needs to continue consolidating the Democratic base. So she's got her husband to deal with. Congratulations to her for that wonderful marriage that has been such a credit to the United States and to our public life now for two decades. But, you know, the thing is, if she's 4, 5, 6 points up right now, assuming that no bad story comes out about her, she wins. It's October 5th. There's 33 days until the election. Trump's not going to make up unless the polls are all wrong right now and Trump is actually leading. He's not making up 5 or 6 points unless something dramatic happens. That's what he did to himself in the first debate. Was he was maybe inching up closer. She was leading. Have to remember, everyone seemed to be thinking that she was losing. She was still leading in the poll average. She was leading by 2, and poll averages don't have margins of error. That's how they function. You add them all together, you essentially, in the classic thing, throwing out the bottom one and the top one, coming with an aggregate in the middle, and therefore you're supposed to sort of see the race fresh. So she was leading, and her lead widened. And that should be all she wrote, unless something happens. Now, well, what could happen?
Do we credit the Julian Assange threats at all?
That was really great.
Yeah, so Assange, tell us about Assange.
Very briefly, there was the idea that WikiLeaks was going to drop some sort of a bomb. Roger Stone, who apparently is in close contact with people at WikiLeaks, which is treasonous.
Stone is the weird amanuensis of Donald Trump, his political amanuensis, quite a brilliant and totally deranged political operative from the 1980s and 90s who has had a remarkable effect on American politics, by the way, in weird ways. Like, he probably took down Elliot Spitzer. He almost certainly helped take down Anthony Weiner. And here he is, basically the person who was the architect of Trump's slow motion takeover of the Republican Party, though he left Trump's employ at some point in the middle of 2015. But anyway, so he is now some kind of liaison, go-between, between Julian Assange of WikiLeaks sitting in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, unable to, as he's been in there, what,
fighting extradition charges for rape.
For rape. So Stone's PR service for Assange includes suddenly turning Sean Hannity into a big fan of Assange's and trying to foment, you know, having Trump talking up Assange. And now basically he was promoting the idea that Assange was about to deliver the death blow to the Hillary Clinton campaign.
Yes, he said that she's over on Wednesday, that she's going to be indicted. And WikiLeaks made this thing sort of like fresh and hip when they moved to this conference because of some sort of threat, some sort of safety threats. It was a middle-of-the-night conference. That happened early Tuesday morning, about 2-3 in the morning, and it was a PR stunt. There was nothing there. They didn't have any new fresh documents. It was the 10-year anniversary of WikiLeaks, so Julian Assange held this droning Skype conference, and all the feverish of fever swamps were just beside themselves over the fact that they had been wiki-rolled, as they called it, into paying attention to this thing that was nothing more than a little bit of self-aggrandizement from Julian Assange. So you had maybe the most entertaining of InfoWars clips I've ever seen occurring in this midnight, late-night broadcast where Alex Jones just broke down, which is really kind of fitting and says quite a lot to say that Alex Jones breaks down, because he does that on almost a daily basis.
I mean, my favorite thing, though, is there's a North Carolina right-winger guy named John Nolte, whom I don't follow on Twitter anymore because he blocked me. But because people screenshotted his tweets, I now know about them. Nolte is now going by the handle CNN is Hitler, just to give you a sense of his forbearance and seriousness. And so yesterday he lost it on the grounds that, you know, Trump was blowing this. He's blowing it, and everybody needs to know, and you have to scream at the top of their lungs so that Trump knows that he's blowing it, because he's going to blow this. He could win this, but he's blowing it, and he's blowing it. And for the first time from inside Trumpkin land, you begin to see people laying out the argument that he is betraying them by his behavior. This is very significant. If he does not do well in the second debate, there is going to be a non, you know, the people who do not believe that what he is going to do is bring about, you know, the new Rome, and he is not going to, you know, bring about the restoration of the sort of, you know, 19th century agrarian plantation economy. But it's just the guy they want because they hate liberals, and he's going to win, and he's going to destroy them, and all this, and they're going to start getting really, really mad at him, the way conservatives and Republicans started getting mad at George H.W. Bush in 1992 after the third debate, when it was really clear that he was going to lose the election, and that he was doing nothing to win it.
So, do you think that would preclude the GOP stabbers in the back? Defense?
Well, it muddies the GOP stabbed us in the back defense, right? I mean, if you have a portion of the normal thing to have happened if Trump loses in November is for the party to get mad at him. Democrats got mad at Dukakis. Democrats got mad at Mondale. Republicans got mad at George H.W. Bush. I wrote the angry Republican conservative mad at George H.W. Bush book in 1993. Republicans got mad at Bob Dole. Democrats got mad at John Kerry. Republicans got mad at McCain and at Romney. If Trump is somehow spared the anger, which is conceivable because movement leaders, if these people genuinely believe that he's a movement head, then of course the movement doesn't die just because he loses an election. He loses an election because he was stabbed in the back, and then people like us stabbed him in the back.
I'm skeptical, if only because Trump himself has created this idea that you can't trust anyone or anything, that polls are all lying to you, that there's this cabal of media people who are suppressing information. Google is suppressing bad information about Hillary Clinton. Online polls are the only things you can trust. It's all a bunch of conspiracy nonsense. And a lot of people believe that. I mean, John Nolte's sort of peeking his head up above the parapet there, but most people are really down in there. And they're more mad at John Nolte, by the way, than they are at Donald Trump at this stage. Yeah. And there's, I have no doubt in my mind that if Donald Trump loses, that he will not go quietly to Mar-a-Lago, that he will declare the election to be a fraud and that he was robbed. And no matter what the results are, it could be a 5-6 point race, 320 electoral votes. He would still make that contention because he cannot lose. He cannot have lost of his own merits. He has to have been robbed and cheated. And his followers will follow him there gleefully. Because it absolves them of any wrongdoing as well.
And so we will never be free of this. The great joke on the Saturday Night Live sketch on Saturday night was Hillary Clinton's, Kate McKinnon is Hillary Clinton's closing statement, where she said, look, just make me president, and I'll just sit in the Oval Office, and I won't open the door for 4 years. And if you don't, I will run for president until I die, and I will never die. But in fact, that could be Trump, couldn't it?
Well, I don't know if he's ever going to run again. I don't think he really wants this experience. I don't think he's having very much fun.
He may not run again, but he will be a kind of this giant picture, yeah, kind of boulder in the path of everyone, just a kind of wrecking ball sitting there that, you know, can be turned, that can be sort of turned up, swung up on the crane and then swung back and forth to knock down things in its path at a moment's notice.
So basically it's Trump and Obama and Hillary Clinton in our lives for the rest of our lives.
Right. Obama told, right, this week Obama's, yeah, been giving pre-election exit interviews, which is another innovation of Obama's. Like, he can't even wait till December to say goodbye. He's got to start saying goodbye in October. That's really great. But basically he's saying, boy, I can't wait till I'm not president anymore because then I can really say what I think. That'll be great. You know, mm-hmm, it's really fantastic to have the ex-president, you know, who is, you know, talk about something that's entirely new, like two-term ex-president who's like in a mouth-off every 5 seconds on
and after Democrats spent the last 8 years gushing over George W. Bush's decision to just disappear.
Yeah.
How noble that was.
Right, and classy. Yeah.
Well, to be fair, if Obama trashes Hillary, if she's president and Obama trashes Hillary from the left, ordinary Democrats are not going to like that. Like, ordinary Democrats are going to want to like Hillary at least for the first year and a half. And if he makes that difficult out of whatever personal reasons he has, or tries to keep her honest or whatever, I don't know that that will go all that well for him. But the point is that we're in uncharted territory. The uncharted territory that began when Trump came to start coming down that escalator in June 2015 is going to extend well beyond November 8th. And we hear the sirens outside and going down 7th Avenue. So I think we're going to call this mercifully to an end. Commentary Magazine, the 71-year-old monthly of intellectual probity and seriousness. Join us at commentarymagazine.com. You get some free reads, and then we ask you to pay $19.95 for a digital subscription and $29.95 for an all-access subscription that includes our beautiful monthly magazine. Please join our conversation at commentarymagazine.com. Follow us on Twitter at Commentary. Like us on Facebook at Commentary. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. We'll talk to you later in the week. Keep the candle burning.